Committee will come to order, the State Government Committee, and for those in the audience that are expecting Phyllis Kahn, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I'm not her. And she's gone today, so I'm the Vice Chair, Representative John Ward, and I will be running the meeting today. Just a reminder, as you address the committee, to please go through me. Also, Phyllis wrote us, Representative Kahn wrote us a special note saying, please make sure, Representative Ward, that all of the members' cell phones are off. A little inside joke for those that... No, she didn't write that. We have an exciting topic today, and do we have a quorum? Okay, when we get a quorum, we will approve the minutes. Till then, we'll move on. Today, we're going to hear testimony from three organizations, the Minnesota Lottery, Minnesota Racing Commission, and the Minnesota Gambling Control Board. And thank the members and the audience for being here. We will have questions. Brian will make sure that you get on the list for questions, so just raise your hand, and Brian will get you on the list in a order, both from the members and from the audience. I'm informed that we do have a quorum now, so Representative Bigham, would you have you read the minutes? And
yes, I have, Chair Ward. I move to approve them. That's your point, right?
That's my point. Is there any discussion, changes, corrections? All in favor, state aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. We will move to testimony then, and we'll call on first Minnesota Lottery, Mr. Harris. Welcome to the committee. And for the record, will you, as you address the committee, would you please state your name and position?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Clint Harris. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Lottery. With me is, to my right is Mr. Don Feeney. He's the Research and Planning Director and my PowerPoint expert. In April, the Minnesota State Lottery will celebrate 17 years of raising money for the state of Minnesota. Through December, over $6 billion in lottery tickets has been sold. Almost $1.5 billion has been returned to the state. Over $3.6 billion has been awarded in prizes. Minnesota retailers have earned over $365 million as well. Today, I'd like to touch on some of the major points of lottery operation and our proposed budget for the next biennium. You have our 2007 overview in your packet, which goes into much more detail. First, what we don't do. Pull tabs and other charitable gambling are items we don't do. We have nothing to do with racetracks or tribal casinos. We do sell scratch-off and online lottery tickets. This is not an easy job. We sell in a highly competitive and rapidly changing marketplace. We have been described as a business and government wrapping. Competition is more than just other gaming. It's every other impulse item sold at a store. We have to compete for shelf space and visibility. No retailer has to sell a lottery ticket, and no player or no customer has to buy a lottery ticket. We offer two basic types of games, scratch and online. Last year, we introduced 42 new scratch games. Each retailer will have between 6 and 20 games available at any one time. Different players have different preferences for game themes, play styles, top prizes, prices, and they like new games. Online games have a longer shelf life. Tickets are generated by a computer terminal at the retailer that is connected to a central system. Powerball is the best known online game, but not the only one. For all games, security is our first priority. Fiscal year 06 was our best sales year ever. We are unlikely to match that level in fiscal year 07. Fiscal year 06 saw record Powerball jackpots of $340 million in October and $365 million this past February. The highest jackpot so far this year is the $240 million, which is drawing tomorrow night. Sales for the $365 million drawing were $6 million. To give you some perspective, sales for last Saturday's drawing with the jackpot of $212 million were a little over $2 million. Sales are difficult to project, depending on things like gas prices, the state of the economy, and particularly the random nature of jackpots like Powerball. Fiscal year 06 was our third straight record year for the money the lottery provided the state. Again, we're unlikely to match that total in 07 because of last year's record Powerball jackpots. And because of a one-time $2.2 million windfall in fiscal year 06 resulting from a legislative reallocation of unclaimed prize money. But we do expect to continue the overall pattern of steady growth we began in 2004. Here's how the lottery dollars divided. The single biggest item, as you can see, is prizes. Without adequate prizes, no one would play. Finding the level that maximizes revenues to the state is always a challenge. Last year, operating costs were 5% of revenue. Retailers earn about 6 cents on every dollar they sell. The lottery contributes to state programs in several ways. Net proceeds are what a business would call profits. The Constitution guarantees that 40% of the proceeds will go to the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund through the year 2024. The rest now goes to the general fund, though that is at the discretion of the legislature. Players have a year to claim prizes. Any that are not claimed after that time go to the general fund, which in fiscal year 06 was $7 million. There is a 6.5% in lieu of sales tax on lottery tickets. Disposition of this is up to the legislature. It is currently split between the Game and Fish Fund, the General Fund, and the Natural Resources Fund, which goes for state, metro, and local parks and trails in the state's three zoos. Each biennium, the legislature makes an appropriation from the lottery prize fund, to finance the Department of Human Services compulsive gambling program. This appropriation was $3.9 million for the current biennium. It is one of the best funded programs in the country. The lottery is the sole source of funding for this program. Every prize winner over 600 is checked for debts owed the state, including back taxes and child support. The lottery has collected over $2 million this way over the last 17 years. And finally, prizes are subject to federal and state income taxes. In fiscal year 06, more than $2 million was withheld for Minnesota state income tax alone. Lottery governance, it was authorized by the voters in the 1988 election. It's operated by a director who is appointed by the governor with advice and consent of the Senate and serves at the pleasure of the governor. Governor and legislature review our budget. Unlike other agencies, we do not receive a line item appropriation. Instead, the legislature establishes a spending limit. The limit covers administrative costs such as personnel, advertising, and data processing, among other things, and it does not cover the cost of tickets, prizes, or retailer commissions. The spending limit was $27.4 million for this fiscal year. We're predicting that our actual operating expenses for 07 will be around $26.2 million. Cuts in operating expenses have come from staff costs, advertising, promotions, and office space reductions. We will continue to invest when it will lead to increased revenues. As an example, we have invested in new scratch ticket dispensers, vending machines, and our new raffle game, which was launched over the holidays. Here you see a history of our operating expense along with our projections for the next biennium. Operating expenses does not include, as I've indicated before, it doesn't include prizes, retailer commissions, or the cost of producing and distributing tickets. These, of course, vary with the level of sales. Another quick shot at our employment history over the years. As you can see, our current count is about 32% lower than about 10 years ago. We anticipate no change from this level. As with most agencies, our biggest expense is personnel costs. In our case, 40% of our operating budget. Lottery salaries and the benefits are determined by the same collective bargaining agreement as every other state agency. By law, we can spend no more than 2.75% of revenue on advertising, Our budgeted figure is considerably below this level, approximately 1.7%. This slide shows our projected revenues for the coming biennium. As I mentioned, the fiscal 06 contributions include a one-time $2.2 million windfall resulting from a legislative reallocation of unclaimed prizes. The general fund is the single greatest beneficiary. Total contributions for the biennium will be approximately $130 million. Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund will receive approximately $62 million. The Game and Fish Fund, $21 million for the biennium. Natural Resources Fund, also $21 million. Under current law, 45% of this money goes for state parks and trails, 45% for metro area parks and trails, and 6% for local trails, and 4% for the state's three zoos. Well, with that, there's a wealth of information on our webpage. The address is on the screen. Please feel free to contact me or my staff at any time. And, of course, you're always welcome to tour our lottery facilities, either collectively or individually, so you can see what it is we do. With that, thank you very much. I'm open to any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Members or the audience, if you have questions, again, raise your hand. Brian will get you on the list. Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Harris, I have a question. You had a slide where you said something about collecting child support or some sort of enforcement. I missed what you were saying there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman.
Mr. Harris.
Yes, we did. By law, we are required to check, ask the Department of Revenue to tell us if there is anybody that owes child support payments or income taxes they have not paid. And if the person who comes forward is tied to their Social Security number, happens to be one of those debtors, we are required to withhold that along with taxes before we give them their payment.
Thank you.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is one thing that we've heard a lot about lately is the a gambling addiction program that is set up through the department. Can you explain? It looks like the funding has relatively stayed between 1.8 and 1.9 for the last few years. Can you explain maybe in a general sense of what kind of programs, one, you offer, whether it's counseling, group two, have you changed anything? Have you grown, you know, spread your wings a little bit about the innovative ways to maybe provide this service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, I hope I said that correctly. We are experts in selling lottery tickets. We don't do any of the programs. What we do is turn over the funds to the Department of Human Services primarily and let them, who are the experts in addictions, arrive at the programs and the funding that they plan on doing. It's primarily in the form of treatment, education, and awareness programs. We've also contributed to the building of Don Feeney's, my problem gambling expert here. What's the name of it? Turnabout? For the facility?
Project Turnabout
down in Granite Falls. There's an actual one of the very few in-house treatment centers in Minnesota, one of the few in the country where you can actually be admitted and treated for problem gambling. It's called Project Turnabout. So other than that, we are the folks that generate the funds for these projects, and the Department of Human Services takes the lead from there.
Chair, follow-up question, please. Mr. Chair, you know, you'll have to pardon me because I'm a rookie here, and I'm just wondering maybe one of the more senior members could answer. Does the lottery report back, or does the Department of Health and Human Services report back to the legislature on progress of these programs, whether they work, whether they need to be expanded, or any idea?
Does anybody have information on that? Well,
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bigham, for the tape, Don Feeney, Research and Planning Director, Minnesota State Lottery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I also serve on the Department of Human Services has an advisory board on for the problem gambling program, which I'm a member of. And I hesitate to speak for the department on this, but I can tell you a few things that I know of. One is that they do report, they prepare a report, I believe, every 2 years to the governor and the legislature, which will be out this year. They typically have reported to the Human Services Policy and Finance Committees, not the State Government Committee, so it's unlikely you'll be hearing from them in this committee, although I'm sure if you asked, they would be here. They are currently working on a evaluation program of treatment outcomes with the larger, the 10 largest treatment providers in the state. There are actually close to 100 people now who are authorized to do problem gambling treatment on behalf of the state, but only there are a handful that see like 80-90% of the clients, and they are studying the outcomes of those. That's a long-term research project. It will probably be a while before the results of that study are available yet at this point, and actually not a tremendous amount of outcome evaluation has been done nationwide. We know short-term it works. Long-term, we're still waiting. Anecdotally, yes, but we don't have the numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Feeney. Representative Bigham, our fiscal analysis, Mr. Roberts is going to do some research on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harris, this is a follow-up to Representative Portman's question, but at what level does a person actually need to go to, like, a regional center to get their money back, or so that you know when you can actually ask for the more detailed information about who they are and what the amount they're collecting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy.
Mr. Harris.
We are, by law, we are required to... the $600 is a threshold. Anything under $600, retailer, you can go to any retailer in the state to collect your prize money. And, of course, there is no check whether you owe the state money. Anything over $600 has to come through any one of the lottery offices where we are checking those prizes. So it's everything over $600.
Thank you.
Or by mail. If we get a prize mailed to a winning ticket mailed to us, we do check. Because the claim form requires their Social Security number.
Any other questions from members of the audience? Representative Sullivan?
Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Harris, you run a very, very good show there at the last day. It's well run. You should take credit, and your employees should take credit. I've not been the strongest supporter of the lottery, as you know, in the past years, but tell me how it is the marketing you do to be able to sell a ticket when somebody knows they're only going to get back 59 cents out of an hour. How are you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Spigum.
Well,
I think there is a certain category of people that enjoy the game. They enjoy the surprise, the reveal. We've actually did an advertising campaign that based on the surprise, if you will. You know, sometimes you don't win, sometimes you win. It's a lot of times it's smaller prizes versus large prizes.
I understand the surprise and enjoyment, but wouldn't they enjoy an 85 cents on a dollar or 90 cents on a dollar? Or
yeah, they would.
Pacific Lake at 98 cents on a dollar better? I'm just amazed that you can sell the tickets. I'm very honest.
Well, probably part of that is the notion of a giant jackpot. Powerball is an example. Quite frankly, the odds are very, very long. 1 in 146 million that you could win the top prize. But it's people like the, even though the chances are very, very tiny, the chance of actually being one that could win 240 million this coming Wednesday night attracts. And the payout for those games are 50%. And so that balances out. So our scratch tickets are really more in the area of 66% payout.
And I sincerely do compliment you on a very good operation. You really do. I'm just always amazed when I see when I go into the convenience store and see these wonderful tickets, beautifully done, by the way. I'm sure that's part of the marketing. But you should take... I'd like to hire you to market some other place.
Well, Mr. Chair, that represents... Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Anybody else? Thank you very much, Mr. Harris, Mr. Feeney. Any tips on where we should go this Wednesday?
Stay in Minnesota. Don't go to Wisconsin.
Very good. We'll now move to Mr. Kruger with the Minnesota Racing Commission. Again, just a reminder to please identify yourself and who you represent, and then speak to the speaker. And again, if you have questions, just raise your hand, and Brian will get your name on the list. Mr. Kruger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dick Kruger, the executive director of the Racing Commission. I did provide staff with a handout that was prepared on for PowerPoint, but since we have been technologically challenged for about the last 4 to 6 years, I have not had the opportunity to actually use it until now. So I'd ask you to perhaps be a little patient with me while I get used to it. I didn't have a chance to rehearse it all. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is give you an overview of the organization and operation of the Racing Commission. It will be my hope that sometime this summer I can get as many of the members of the committee out to the racetrack to spend a day with us, with the stewards in their morning duties and the afternoon in the races, and perhaps morning rounds with our veterinarians. It's much more meaningful to actually be on the racetrack grounds to see and participate in what we do, but I'll give you my best overview of that this afternoon. And then I also want to conclude with giving you a chronology of the North Metro racetrack, which just had the groundbreaking this last Thursday, to be located just west of Forest Lake in the city of Columbus, and then a brief status report on the where Canterbury Park is right now. The commission is comprised of 9 members appointed by the governor with Senate confirmation. Each commissioner serves for 6 years, so three members are up every other year for reappointment. Minnesota statutes, chapter 240.03, delineates the commission's powers and duties with regard to their oversight and regulation of pari-mutuel gambling in the state, which now includes the card club, which the legislature authorized back in the 2000 session. In applying that those powers and duties, the commission has some primary responsibilities. Those are listed on page 2 of the handout. I will not go through them other than to discuss the primary responsibility, which is the licensing of racetracks and the occupational licenses that the legislature has empowered them with. 240.10 authorizes, statute chapter 240.10 authorizes the commission to issue Class A licenses, which are racetrack ownership licenses, and in that statute it does set a fee of $253,000 a year. It also authorizes the commission to issue Class B licenses, which are racing licenses, for an organization to conduct at a Class A facility, and the license fee for that license is statutorily set at $500 for a live day and $100 for any simulcast day. The legislature is also authorizes the commission to issue Class C or occupational licenses. That's whereby anybody that works at the racetrack or provides a service or a product to the racetrack in the form of a concessionaire must also be licensed. Everybody goes through a detailed application process and a background investigation, including fingerprinting every 5 years, which the legislature requires. Last year, we issued just over 4,100 licenses. 2,200 were issued to Minnesota residents, and the balance of the licenses were issued to folks from 43 other states, as well as Mexico, Canada, and England. The legislature has also authorized the Class D license, which is a license for a county agricultural society to race pari-mutuelly during its county fair event. We have had only one county fair that raced, and that was the Traverse County Fair in Wheaton, and they raced from pari-mutuelly from 1994 through 2001. Commission staff and budget. on page 3 of the handout, you do have an organization chart of the commission and staff. We have 8.3 full-time equivalent positions. As well, during live racing, we do add contract positions. So we have 3 stewards, 3 commission veterinarians, and some substitute veterinarians. And I'll go into more detail into what their responsibilities are in a minute. Our fiscal 06, I'm going to jump ahead here for a minute. Our fiscal 06 appropriated special revenue funds. Now, those license fees I talked about are receipts that we receive, but they are deposited in special revenue fund, and they are appropriated by the legislature. In other words, you set our spending authority based upon the revenue estimates that that we make for this biennium and the next biennium. And our fiscal 07 budgeted expenditures are $670,000. Now, that is less than what was appropriated for this year because we didn't take in some of the license revenue that we were expecting when we were presenting our budget 2 years ago. And that's mainly because of the delay in the new racetrack opening, and I'll get to that at the end of my presentation. The handle, betting handle at Canterbury Park, or their gross receipts are on pages 5 and 6 of the handout, and they go back and compare the handle back to 1985. Two years ago, when I was over here testifying, I was able to say that the handle has been showing modest increases, and it's what happens at Canterbury Park that the state's horsemen and women make their investment decisions in bloodstock. As you can see, the handle is starting to decline. It's actually gone down about 8.5% from where it was at the end of 2004. That may get reflected in the next few years as far as investment by the state's horsemen and women into their racing and breeding stock.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Honey?
Could I just ask the testifier real quick, what's a handle?
That's the betting handle. Mr. Governor Portman, that's the when you make a $2 bet, that's part of the handle.
The entire $2 is part of the handle or a portion of that? When you're referring to handle, are you talking about money taken in bets?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Kruger, if you could just hold on for a minute, we have now found the handle. We did not have the handout originally, so we've been going off the screen. We have the handout now that has been distributed to members.
The handout?
Yes.
Okay. And if I can continue, Mr. Chairman, the decline in the betting handle has also affected, obviously, Canterbury's revenues, but they also affect the state revenues, because in 2004, we collected about $247,000 for the general fund. That is a non-dedicated receipt, and it went down to just over $220,000 in fiscal 5. Now, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I'll go over the primary staff functions during live racing, that being stewards and veterinarians. And I should add in this part that we do have a statutory appropriation financing these activities. That's in 241.55. It's the reimbursement procedures and accounts that we get reimbursed directly from the racetrack for providing stewards and veterinarians. By law, the stewards are the highest ranking racing officials at the racetrack. There must be 3 during each race meet, 2 of whom must be either employees or contractors of the commission, and one of those 2 must be the presiding steward. And since 1990, the commission has been contracting for all 3 stewards. They, in effect, operate as the referees of the racing event. They have provided to them video technology whereby one of the stewards is watching the race as it's being run live from 4 different angles. They also have replay capability, much like you see in professional football, so that if something does happen during the running of a race, they can replay the event, where it happened, talk to the jockeys, and try to get a resolution as to any type of an infraction that may have occurred. If they should make a decision to disqualify a horse, that decision is final and cannot be appealed. The legislature has also given the stewards judicial powers. They sit as a board of judges. They conduct administrative hearings. They issue findings of fact, conclusions, and an order. The legislature has given them authority to fine individuals up to $2,000 and to suspend their licenses up to 90 days. The veterinary program of the commission is where the regulatory oversight of the commission focuses more.
Mr. Herbert, Mr. Coffey?
Can I just ask a question about the stewards? Sorry to interrupt your presentation, but I just wanted to know, what kind of background do they have as far as, are they then attorneys, or are they horse people, or are they, what kind of additional skill or background or expertise or licensure do they have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy.
Mr. Kruger?
The three stewards that we have now, two of them are ex-riders. They were formerly jockeys. One of them has been with us now about 10 years, so he's very familiar with our statutes and our rules. Our other steward has been a steward for a number of years. He comes up to Minnesota in the summer, and now he's at Turf Paradise in Phoenix, Arizona. None of them are lawyers. They have gone through, we're a member of an organization called Racing Commissioners International. That has a formal accreditation program for stewards where they're required to fulfill, I think it's 5 or 6 days of initial training to be certified as a steward, and then every 2 years it's 16 hours of continuing education. So they're not lawyers, but they're very familiar with racing rules, customs of the turf, if you will, conduct on the racetrack, especially since we've got two ex-riders up in the stand that, you know, they bring their experience qualifications into any decision that they have to make. Part of that training, Representative Poppy, is conducting hearings, writing findings of fact and conclusions in an order. So, and it's fairly standard from state to state because all the state stewards now are going through that same training.
Thanks.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
In the veterinary program, the regulatory focus here is more on animal husbandry than it is on the actual gambling. Dr. Hobda, our chief veterinarian, is here today. Each time a horse comes on the racetrack, they create a medical record and update that record every time they examine a horse. Last year, just under 1,500 records were maintained by the commission's veterinary staff. And as I mentioned, that record is updated each time a horse is examined, whether prior to a race or as a follow-up to an injury or an illness. We also conduct pre-race exams in Minnesota. Every morning on a race day, two of the veterinarians will do their morning rounds. They will look at every horse that's going to race that day. Last summer, they conducted just under 5,600 pre-race exams. Each horse is observed further on race day in the walking ring, in the paddock, and in the post-parade just prior to a race. The result of those exams last summer, caused the placing of 238 horses on the vets list, which means that horse did not race again until it has completed the workout under the visual supervision of the commission's vet. The commission's medical testing program is administered under contract with Truesdale Laboratories in Tustin, California. The cost of that, again, is reimbursed to the commission under Minnesota Statute Chapter 24155. After each race, at least two horses are taken to the test barn under our chain of custody. We have tests in the winner's circle that accompany the horses to the test barn. One of those horses must be the winner. And in the detention barn, both blood and urine are obtained from those horses. And under that chain of custody, it is witnessed by an owner witnessed by an employee of the owner or trainer, and is packed and sealed and shipped to Truesdale Laboratory. Last year, we sent just over 3,000 samples to that lab, and we have 52 violations, all of which were dealt with appropriately by the stewards. Moving on to the Breeders' Fund, Minnesota Statute Chapter 240.18 authorizes a tax of 1% on the handle to be deposited in the Minnesota Breeders' Fund. We are, by statute, authorized to administer that fund that costs us about $32,000 a year to administer the Breeders' Fund. After we deduct that, 20% is set aside for equine research and related education, which is dedicated for the University of Minnesota School of Veterinary Medicine. The remaining 80% goes back to the industry in the form of Breeders' Awards, Stallion Awards, and purse supplements. And we are estimating that to total about $1.2 million for each year of the next biennium. Now, that's money that's going back to the horse farms in the state, and you know, they use that for breeding stock, breeding fees, they pay their vet bills, and things like that. Part of that also is generated from the card club. When the legislature established the card club, it was their intent, and it's stated in the law, to improve the horse racing industry by improving purses. So the rake from the card club adds about $500,000 to the purse supplement account in the Breeders' Fund. Legislation, as I mentioned earlier, legislation authorizing a Class A license to operate a card club did pass the 99-9 session. After live racing in 99, Canterbury began composing their plan of operation. We reviewed it with them. We also brought in commissioners and other staff, special agents from the Alcohol Gambling Enforcement Division, and police officers from the Shakopee Police Department to participate in the review of that plan of operation. The only reason I mention that is because we will be using that same protocol when we review the plan of operation for the new track up in Anoka County, although it'll probably be the sheriff, the Anoka County Sheriff's Office that we'll be working with. The commission approved the plan during its commission meeting in January of 2000. The essential details of the plan were as stipulated by the legislature. The overall policies for security and surveillance and internal controls, the games to be played, hours of operation, the collection or rake amounts, dealer and dealing procedures, and patron and employee licensee conduct in the card room. Page 8 of the handout, or what's on the PowerPoint, displays the rake and purse amount set aside since 2000, the year the card club opened. The rake for 2006 was $29.5 million. Of that, $4.5 million was set aside for purses, and of that $4.5 million, $453,000 was paid to the commission to be used for purse supplements for Minnesota bred restricted races. It's money dedicated to go back to Minnesota breeders and owners. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude my overview and just briefly, if I could, discuss North Metro, where we have gone over the last 3 years with that licensee. They initially filed their application for a license on December 23rd of 2003, and throughout 2004 we did our review and evaluation of that application. Commissioner Darcy Heitzman appointed an ad hoc committee to review the application in detail. That committee held 9 meetings throughout the summer and fall of 2004. We also contracted with an outside accounting firm to do an independent evaluation and financial review. What are the sources of financing? Where's the money coming from? And we did have 2 public hearings. We're required by statute to have one in the community where the track is to be located. And we also had a second hearing in Shakopee at the petition of the Canterbury Park horse men and women that were racing out there. The commission approved the licenses in January of 2005. And then, as you all probably know, some litigation commenced against the commission by the an organization called Columbus Concerned Citizens. They sued the commission on two bases, one for violation of the open meeting law, and the other one for just the review process that we used in approval of the license applications. We did prevail in both of those matters in the Court of Appeals. Obviously, that held up progress by North Metro on construction of the racetrack. They did have their groundbreaking this past Thursday. They overcame their second to the last hurdle early in December when they got approved from the Corps of Engineers for their mitigation plan on the archaeological work that had been done out there. Some artifacts began to appear when they initially started to work out there. And then just this past month, they got a final approval letter of commitment on their financing for the facility. They have informed the commission that they do plan to have a spring meet in 2008. They have also let the commission know that they will be proposing legislation that was over here the last 2 years. One would be to allow full card all breed simulcasting. Right now, statute limits them only to the breed that they race live. So they'll be back looking for all breed simulcasting, as well as the statute currently limits them to opening the card club after they have raced 50 days. They will be looking for approval from the legislature to open the card club after the commission has assigned 50 days. And we have, if they're going to race next year, we have to assign days before the end of this calendar year, by next December. Just a brief state of the condition of Canterbury Park. As I mentioned in their handle, Card Club's doing well, as you can see by that presentation, but their handle has declined 8.5% since 2004. And as I mentioned, that affects both their revenues and the revenues that they pay us for deposit in the general fund. I did review their 10Q that they're required to file with the SEC every year, and I compared the first three quarters of 2006 with the first three quarters of 2005 and their net income. Their net income was down just over 8%. So in reaction to that, Canterbury Management has asked their employees for things like voluntary leaves of absence, reduced hours of work, and things like that. You know, if that doesn't work, they're looking at potential layoffs or mandatory reduced hours of work or perhaps job elimination or layoffs. It remains to be seen how that'll play out over the next this quarter and maybe into next quarter. I know they had a decent December as far as simulcasting. You know, most of the handle decline is coming in the simulcast area, and we attribute that mainly to people betting on the internet. People are just staying at home and betting and not making the trip to come out to the racetrack. But this may all, you know, play out over the next few months, but I just felt compelled to let the committee know that. They have indicated to the commission that they do not plan to submit any legislation at this time. As you know, they've had Racino legislation over here and some other legislation on lifting the 50 table limit on card tables in the card room, but they've indicated to the commission now that they're not at this time going to be doing that. That concludes my overview, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry if it went on a little longer than you had expected.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kruger. We do have some questions from members. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kruger, I realized as I was listening to you, I don't think I've ever really been clear on the technical meaning of parimutuel. What factors at Canterbury make that gaming or wagering facility a parimutuel entity, whether it be the racing or the card club?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Harris,
Senator Rush, parimutuel it derives from a French term meaning betting among ourselves. You know, we're all out at the racetrack and you're all betting on horses. That all goes into a win pool, a place pool, a show pool. Doesn't matter to Canterbury which horse finishes first, which finishes second, which finishes third. If you happen to be the only one to bet on the horse that finished first,
you get all the money that was bet on that horse to finish first, except for 17%, which is the statutory takeout that Canterbury withdraws from the pool, pay its taxes, pay its purses, and pay its cost of operation, and to pay its tax to the breeders' fund.
Okay. So
they have no stake in who wins or who loses, and it's the same in the card room. They take a rake, either $4 or $4.50 out of the pot. Doesn't matter to Canterbury who wins.
And then just one question. Mr. Chair, Mr. Kruger, so as a percentage of other like facilities around the nation, are they all paramutual facilities similar to Canterbury, or there are others that are not?
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, they are all like Canterbury.
Okay, thank you.
It's all paramutual internationally, not just in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sullivan?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Kruger, for the Northern Track, did we authorize 50 card tables for the Northern Track similar to Canterbury?
Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Representative Spigum, they in effect, any new racetrack will be grandfathered in under that statute.
With the 50 tables.
That's correct.
Well, Mr. Kruger, then my question is, what was the rationale we used, and I should know it, but I don't, the rationale we use for saying that they could not begin the card club or the card games until 50 days after the first racing date, as opposed to after the authorization of the bill that they have introduced. What type of rationale did we use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stragum, I can only guess that it was the legislature's intent that they show a commitment for live horse racing before they open up the card club.
Was there nothing more than that, though? Nothing more than the fact that they're there and they're operating and they exist.
That's correct. And I might add, for any racetrack to retain its Class A license, they must race 50 days every year, or the commission must revoke their license.
And, Mr. Chairman, the last question. In your humble opinion, Mr. Kruger, and I realize that from the commission standpoint as executive director, you're more concerned about the integrity of racing and the integrity of the operation than anything else. But you you certainly made mention of the fact that the handle was down, the off-track betting was down, lay off some employees potential, or at least going on some type of a voluntary leave. Not good situations, any of them. In your humble opinion, what would be the steps we could do to make sure to help Canterbury be more successful so they don't have to lay off employees and they don't have to move ahead into any type of a retraction as opposed to an expansion, if we'd like to see?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Spigum, it would be, you know, perhaps sitting down with Canterbury and asking them, you know, what they would need as far as legislation to increase their revenues. You know, it could be, you know, take off the limitation on the 50 table limit. I know on the weekends when I'm out there are people waiting to sit down to play poker. You know, their tax right now is very low, so I don't think there's any way. The legislature might entertain tax relief because it's very low right now anyway. But I would suggest that you sit down with Canterbury Park and discuss some of that. I'm not trying to avoid your question, Representative Swigum.
I have done that, Mr. Kruger. I was just wondering, as a regulator, as the person involved with the integrity of the commission, what's your suggestion?
The one thing we do watch, though, when if they're going to have to start doing that, that we will have a role in their surveillance and security operations. And that's the core of integrity and public safety, licensee safety at the racetrack. So we will play a role if they have to start doing that, so that we don't jeopardize the record that we've had out there in the last 22 years.
Members? Representative Gorman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the slide number 9, where it talks about your financial summary, and it looks like starting in 2004 that the revenue that
the Racing Commission brings in goes into a special revenue fund, and then that special revenue fund is used to finance your operations instead of maybe the revenue coming into the general fund and then coming back out of the general fund. I'm not sure if I am understanding the chart 100%. How much money does the Racing Commission deposit in the special revenue fund each year, and where does that money come from?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Poppy.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Kruger. It comes from the license fees. For 2006, we received $722,000 in license fees. Fiscal 7, we received $698,000 in license fees. Even though the legislature, and I don't know if I have that with me, you appropriated more than that, but we didn't take in that much, so we can't spend it. The cash isn't there. And in 08 and 09, we're forecasting $868,000. And that's all from the A license, the B license, and the Class C occupational licenses. And they differ from year to year because, you know, we had thought the racetrack, the North Metro track, was going to be racing last year, which meant they would have paid us an additional $50,000, which we didn't collect. That hasn't even been forecasted for this year, but it is in for the next 2 years of the next biennium, 08 and 09. And prior to the change in 2003, which was based on a governor's recommendation, we were financed out of the general fund. But the governor changed, wanted to fund it out of dedicated receipts, and it did require a significant increase in the Class A license fee. It went from $10,000 a year to $253,000 a year.
Follow-up?
Yes, Representative Corman.
So I understand, it looks to me like it's a self-supporting entity, like the taxpayers in the state of Minnesota are not subsidizing, if you could say it that way, the racing industry by funding the Racing Commission. The Racing Commission is paid for by revenues that are generated from the activities that it regulates.
That's correct.
And is there any tax collected? I was just a little curious about the statement in the governor's budget that said that the Racing Commission collects general fund taxes and fines of $235,000. And I was just totaling up the money that's wagered there, and it looks like it's up in the $100 million range, and I understand expenses are probably pretty high with this type of an operation, but are there any, is that the full amount of general fund taxes is $235,000, and what is that on? Like, if I go to Canterbury and I place a wager and I win back some money, is there tax collected on that and remitted to the state, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wortman.
Wortman.
The pari-mutuel tax is a tax that goes to the general fund. It does not kick in on a fiscal year basis until the takeout reaches $12 million. And then it's taxed at the rate of 6%. That usually kicks in about the middle to the end of April. This year I'm guessing it's going to be toward the end of April. And it totals for 05 it was $247,000. For 06 it was $221,000. Now in addition to that, whenever the stewards fine an individual, and I think in 05 it was $14,000 and last year it was something like $10,000. That also goes into the general fund. So, but that's a tax literally on the handle. It's not a tax on you when you make a bet at the racetrack. Unless you were to cash a signer where you might have to fill out a W-2G if you have a big winning ticket, and they do withhold on big winnings.
And my last question is the $295,000 that the governor's asking for a computer upgrade, that looks like that's coming from the special revenue fund and not the general fund?
That's correct. you know, that money, if you look at our base budget and you look at the initiative that we've gotten support now from the governor's office, that is more than we're estimating in receipts. That's because of the money we've collected during this biennium that we didn't spend. It carries over. It's in a control account in the special revenue fund. It gets transferred by the Department of Finance as we need it. But, you know, we did that analysis and came up with $359,000. It could go up. It could go down by the time we're done with this biennium. But we had an initial estimate to upgrade our information technology that was just over $400,000. I mean, we are technologically challenged in our office just simply because we haven't had the money to do the things. So we even identified a staff 6 years ago that we needed to get on top of. But became very apparent when the legislative auditor was in at the end of 2004 with an evaluation audit and recommended that we needed to increase our information technology capabilities. So it's no new money, and it's no general fund money. It's all fee revenue from the industry.
Thank you.
Representative Wilkie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kruger, just to back up to the question of layoffs, I had the impression when you were talking about that all of those problems were related to the racing at the track and not to the card club. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, I'm not clear. I'm not clear what
you mentioned the potential for layoffs, Mr. Kruger. And I had the impression at the time that you were talking about these being related to the actual horse racing and not to card club.
That's
activity.
Correct.
So I'm wondering how we would make the connection between any additional activity in the card club having any relationship to whether people that were working in the racing activities were laid off or not. I mean, if we doubled the tables at card club as had been proposed in the past and we had 100 tables instead of 50, would that have any implications for how many people were employed in the horse racing activity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, it could, as far as the increase of revenues in one sector of their business, whether it's card club racing or food and beverage. You know, as a corporation, they can assign those dollars however they want in meeting their expenses. But what they're trying to do is try to get a handle. If these revenues, the handle stays down, the betting handle stays down, they're trying to get a handle on it now rather than waiting, you know, until the end of this year if the figures should continue to decline. I'm speaking for them. I just wanted the committee to be aware of this. You might want to get some testimony from Canterbury.
Thank you, Mr. Kruger.
Members, anything else? Question from the audience? Thank you, Ms. Kruger, very much for your presentation. We'll call on Mr. Barrett with the Minnesota Gambling Control Board to finish us up for the day. And again, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom Barrett. I'm the director of the Gambling Control Board. Prior to the meeting, I did provide staff copies with two specific reports. One is our annual report, and then one is called the financial summary. It's a legal size, but a detailed listing of all the licensed organizations we're currently have under license. And it's a great summary of the activity that these organizations, the volume of sales, the expenditures, the charitable donations in summary. And I provide that for good information. You'll see some things related to the taxes and the expenses, an issue that's hot. But if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I'd go through the PowerPoint to give the committee a good idea of what it is we do at the Gambling Control Board.
Very good, Mr. Mayor.
Our mission is twofold. One, it's to ensure the integrity of the game, so obviously the players out there and that are participating in the game know if the games are fair and honest. But also, the second part is to help the nonprofits to raise funds so that the dollars earned can go to the charitable causes, be it the veterans, the youth hockey, the fire relief. What is lawful charitable gambling? There's five forms that we are currently regulating: pull tabs, bingo, paddle wheels, tip boards, and raffles. And I highlight the fact when we see paddle wheels, it's not the riverboat paddle wheels, the Wheel of Fortune paddle wheel. We had a question earlier. Other gambling that's not regulated, sometimes we'll get calls. We work very close with our counterparts, but yes, the lottery, as you heard previously, are on their own. Tribal casinos comes under the eye of the Department of Public Safety, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, in terms of testing and sampling some of the machines there. Horse racing, as you just heard, with the Racing Commission. And then there's the illegal internet, be it sports boards, also under the watchful eye of the Department of Public Safety, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement. But I point out, this is the area that the Gambling Control Board works very closely with the Department of Public Safety when my staff are out doing inspections and the like, and we find some instances of illegal activity. Obviously, we'll bring in the assistance from Public Safety. Who regulates lawful gambling? We have a seven-member citizens board. Five are appointed by the governor. One is appointed by the attorney general, and one is appointed by the commissioner of public safety. I have a great staff of approximately 32 full-time equivalents, and we're split out the licensing, the compliance, which is similar to the auditors, investigations, the site inspections primarily, and also a couple folks for administration. How do we regulate? A couple of ways. One, we license anybody that has something to do with charitable gambling, whether it's the organizations, the nonprofits, the gambling managers that work for the nonprofits, the manufacturers that produce the products, the distributors that deliver the products, and then something relatively new, Link Bingo. And I'll talk about that a little later. We also do it through education and training. Anybody that's primarily focusing on with the gambling managers, we'll put them through training, and they're required to take continuing education in the year as well. Approving and testing games. By sheer volume, last year we averaged approval of over 340 games on average per month, or just over 4,000 games, primarily the pull tab games. But tremendous amount of volume coming through our doors for inspection and testing. Regulatory audit site inspections, again, this is where we're working close with the nonprofit organizations to make sure that the activities that are being reported are reported accurately and the money is spent for the proper purposes. If some of those things up above don't work, then obviously there is the opportunity to get attention and make corrective measures through fines, suspensions, revocations. Who do we regulate? The industry we regulate. There's over 3,300 sites currently licensed in Minnesota conduct charitable gambling. Over 1,400 charitable organizations. Each one of those needs a gambling manager. Last year we issued over 2,400 exempt or excluded permits. Those are what we would consider relatively small raffle type permits, be it a church. But when I say small, top prize could go upwards of 50,000. Roughly 13,000 paid gambling employees we're tracking in our system. That kind of fluctuates to the extent the organizations keep us informed of as they change. Two Link Bingo game providers, 14 distributors located throughout the state, and then we also have 10 manufacturers. Only one of those 10 have a plant within the boundaries of Minnesota. Charitable gambling numbers, $1.3 billion in gross receipts in fiscal year 06. Minnesota ranks number one in the country when it comes to charitable gambling. On the heels of that, $51 million last year was deposited in terms of net tax receipts for the general fund. Again, Minnesota's number one in the country related to that. And our budget currently from last year was 2.6. And the reason I point that out, while those numbers up above are big, the regulatory budget is one of the smallest in the country. We have a relatively good thing going in Minnesota. We're losing some groundwork. There's some concerns, but we think we're doing a fairly good job. The five forms, the bread and butter of the charitable gambling industry, making up 93%, comes by the way of the pull tab sales. Bingo, which is second and only 5%, but when we say only, at just over $64 million, it all adds up. And then you can see raffles, paddle wheels, and the tip board sales. Lottery versus charitable. With all due respect to our counterparts in lottery, and I think they just had a record year, and good for them. But by comparison, charitable gambling in Minnesota, again, $1.3 billion, it's nearly three times the size, and I think it's a point that a lot of folks don't know or realize how many of those pull tab booths for charitable organizations, how it all adds up. Big industry. Where does the money go? Approximately 81% goes right back to the player in terms of the prizes. Taxes currently, and taxes, while it's a single number here, it's a there's different tax rates based on what game or based on the activity, but overall roughly 4% of the gross receipts comes back to the state. In terms of taxes, organizations are contributing roughly 5%, or this time nearly $65 million last year for charitable contributions. Organizations obviously paying the expenses, be it salaries, the games, roughly 10%, and then part of our budget, which comes by the way of fees with the organizations, amounts to the 2.6. On a symbolic gesture, somebody always asks, where is, you know, if you had to break apart that $1 you paid for pull tabs, where did the money go in terms of the regulations? So out of those 100 pennies, our cost, my agency, is roughly one-fifth of one of those pennies, to give you a perspective visual of the regulation. Some of the issues and concerns I think are interesting. I want to touch briefly on the staffing ratios. Expense limits for the charities, you'll be hearing a little bit more on that. That's an issue that's of mounting concern. Impact from a smoking ban. The year in review, and I'll try to give you the short version. And then looking ahead, some of the things that we're focusing on the Gambling Control Board as it relates to charitable gambling. Staffing ratios, briefly, we have approximately one investigator for every 1,300 sites. I use the comparison. You had a game warden on, knew you're only going to have a game warden on one of 1,300 lakes, would you keep that extra walleye or maybe go over the limit? It's a concern we have, but obviously the charities run the risk of being caught if they're doing something wrong. But so far, so good. Again, we work closely with the Department of Public Safety as it relates to not duplication of effort. Compliance specialists, these are the auditor types that are looking at the books and reviewing the expenditures. Each one of those have approximately 197 sites to be mindful of, 83 organizations. We're not there yet, but we're hopefully approaching an audit cycle of roughly once every 2 years. And then a licensing specialist. Again, these are folks, before you can get involved in gambling, have to apply. We have to make sure you're certified as a nonprofit, et cetera. Expense limits for charities. This is an issue that's raised a concern, but just by way of background, under current law, charities may not spend more than 60% of the net profits for expenses. If by chance they're involved in bingo operation, which is a little more labor intensive, they're allowed to go up to 70%. Unfortunately, right now we're tracking roughly 23%, 300 organizations that are at or above those expense limits, and that's a concern. Part of the concern is penalties over the past, I would say, have been somewhat minimal. We've worked with the industry to improve in some of their expenditures and what's being charged for rent. But at the same time, to limit the penalty to a $500 per occurrence when somebody might be overspending in the $20,000, $30,000 range, we kind of wonder how much we can get their attention. So that is an issue that we're addressing in one of our legislative initiatives, and we'll probably be coming back before this committee to address. Impact from a smoking ban, let me first say up front, because I know this is an issue, the board is neutral on the policy, definitely, but we've been tracking some of the impact as relates to the charity, somewhat related to the mission in terms of monitoring the charity so they do the right job, but when we see the impact of the smoking ban on a charity and maybe some of the inconsistent enforcement or regulation, we do have some numbers that are available, and I make them available to the committee as well. But for an example, statewide gross receipts for charitable gambling are down approximately 5%. Comparison, the areas that have a smoking ban right now, depending upon what area you're in, we've seen decreases ranging from 14% to 100%. Some sites have totally gotten out of the business. The last bingo hall in St. Paul will be closing at the end of this month. By comparison, exempt sites, Hennepin County had a full ban, and they later changed to a partial ban that sites could request an exemption. For those sites that requested and received an exemption, those sites are up 9% as relates to charitable gambling. And again, the reason I'm pointing this out, because I know it's an issue for concern, there is an impact as relates to the charitable gaming industry when we talk about smoking ban. The year in review on some of the highlights, regulatory site inspections have increased. We're very happy with that. Organizations, believe it or not, like to see us out there. If they have some issues they need to address, they welcome our input. But I think once we get out there, we find some problems. It's better to work them out with the organization. We've done something new this year. It's what we call Sweets Week, but we partner up with the Department of Revenue, Department of Public Safety. We'll geographically target a location in the state, and we will go out as a team and stop at these sites. Everything from maybe liquor coming across the border from Iowa, or maybe illegal sports boards. Those are some of the things we found in our coordinated effort, but it's a point to be made in terms of working together with our counterparts, the other state agencies, to avoid duplication. We had one instance where one of my investigators came in, and 2 days later, one of the public safety investors came in. And so we're talking more effectively, and we actually conducted what we call sweeps, and it was very successful. Cash shortages. Again, this is a $1.3 billion industry, and it's all cash. But since 1985, for the fiscal year just closed, we had the lowest cash shortage reported by the organization. It's an example where the charities are working with the bar owners or whoever's handling the cash. It's still a large amount, but it's lower, and hopefully it'll continue to drop. Link Bingo. Those that have been around before heard what Link Bingo is, but it's it finally got its start. They found legislation that would allow for charities that are conducting bingo to connect with each other and play for a common prize pool. And it's been quite successful. I think on average there's roughly 23 sites around Minnesota. It's only Minnesota that are participating in any one linked bingo game. The biggest jackpot thus far is, I think, we're upwards of $2,400. Obviously, it pales in comparison to jackpots at the lottery. But, again, it's something that's helped the charity nonetheless. And we were able to find a way to regulate that game. We did revise the rule book, made it shorter, easier to understand. Charitable gambling, very complicated, but hopefully we've eased some of the pain and reduced some of the verbiage. Ducks, cows, and golf balls. And I just made some light mention that it seems a couple years ago we had the rubber duck race legislation pass. That was big. Well, it's passed and it's up and it's running. But since then, it allows for other forms of raffles, as creative as they may. We look to see what works, what doesn't work. Golf balls in reference to a bucket raised above a golf course, and they release it, and whatever ball ends up closest during the hole wins. Cows, every year we get requests for cow bingo. I won't go into those details. That's not a lawful form yet, and I don't anticipate it. Something about using live animals. And then location, location, location. Again, this is somewhat going back to the smoking ban, but I bring an example where we had one site in St. Paul that's affected by the smoking ban that is down receipt-wise roughly 75%. The same street, but up a half a mile in the city of Maplewood, that is not under smoking ban, the bar had to expand the parking lot just because of the increase in attendance there. Looking ahead, there's a few initiatives that we're looking for, trying to work with the organization on expenses. Again, this is one of those hot issues. Education requirements, we just some technical changes to make it a little easier for managers to get out and get the training they need. Record retention to the extent that we can save organization expense. That's an option we're exploring. Linked bingo, we weren't sure what we were getting into when we got into it. We now know more, and we're going to remove the requirements that they had to have a separate bank account for the linked bingo. We found that's not necessary. And then charitable gambling. For the Gambling Control Board, and what we regulate is lawful, but also often people I'm asked, do you regulate the lottery? And so there's some thought consideration given to replacing the word lawful and put the word charitable back into what it is we regulate. I know there's some sensitive issues out there, but that's one of the things that's on our plate. Automation, we're on the edge of having a new system with my hopes of having online license application. Right now everything's pretty much manual. budget. We'll be coming back in detail, but right now, just advance warning, there's no increase, no changes proposed. We're operating under a dedicated fee system. The people that we license, regulate, are the ones that are paying for the regulation. And we will continue to keep a watchful eye on what happens should it be a smoking ban or talk of maybe changes affecting Texas Hold'em type tournaments and other gambling proposals, be it sports for it. So it's things that we'll be monitoring. And certainly if you get any questions, I'd be happy to follow up individually. We have some information on that. And then obviously when all that's done, we'll maintain our mission.
Mr. Baird, I'm sure we're going to have some questions, and I just want to start with, you mentioned the smoking ban, and you have figures available. Are they mostly figures from the metro, or do you have figures in the outstate, greater Minnesota as well?
Mr. Chair, when we started, it was just...
Mr. Baird.
Thank you. We're trying to keep track of every municipality that has some kind of a ban. I think we're doing a pretty good job, but you know, we might miss one, but we have greater Minnesota, whether it's Duluth, or Rochester, so I'd be happy to share that information as well.
Would you give the committee that information?
Yes, and just an example, those that are familiar, and again, I don't want to sound like I'm advocating, but I think it's important for the committee, legislators, the impact that we've seen. But an example of St. Paul where they had a partial ban, and then they went to a full ban.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the charitable gambling receipts go from 14% drop to upwards of 40. Conversely, across the river, Minneapolis had a full ban in Hennepin County, and then ended up going to a partial ban in Hennepin County, and just reversed. So it's inconsistent out there. Bloomington, I think there's restriction on so many feet within the establishment. But we do have, if we're tracking all, it started out innocent. We're just more mindful of what could happen, but we've been getting a lot of requests. So I can't just share with the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. We have about 10 minutes left, and so I know we have questions, and we'll... go as rapid as we can so we get everybody's question in. Representative Portman?
Thank you. I have similar questions to my questions for the last testifier, but I'm having a harder time tracking it. It with the Gambling Control Board, is it totally self-supporting and in that there's no general fund appropriations funding your activities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, yes, it's totally. A few years ago, we were under a general fund appropriation. But now we've switched to a dedicated, and it's off the fees that we charge. The penalties that we assess do not come to us. They continue to go to the general fund as non-dedicated, lest we be accused of racking up the penalties.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Horman.
So you're a net positive impact on the general fund, right?
Mr. Chair, yes. The reference, when you say us, I want to make the give credit to the charities. We're the regulators, but the taxes, I think, are what you're talking about. Last year, $51 million went to the general fund in the way of taxes as a positive. None of the taxes that were collected went towards regulation. That was totally separate.
Okay, so the fees support your agency and the taxes go right into the general fund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, correct.
Okay.
Representative Strickland.
Mr. Chairman, Tom, the way I see it, you're going to be out of the job here in a few years, very few short years. I think the gross receipts are down for law and gambling every one of the past how many years? 10, 12, 8, 0.08, felony DWI. It all affects our VFWs, our Legions, our Elks, Knights of Columbus. I'm sure you all visit them like I do. And Tom, I think the smoking ban that you referred to would be just enough to put the nail in the coffin. You only need to go to your VFW or your Legions and talk to the folks that are there to know that to be true. Not only does that affect the receipts Representative Portman to the state, but more importantly, I think, to our local communities, the amount that they contribute to our local boys clubs, girls softball teams, girls clubs, boys and girls clubs, whatever it may be, pretty significant. And I think we need to at least be aware of your words before we move ahead with the legislation this year. No comment necessary, just comment to myself.
Hey, do you want to comment, Mr.
Chair? Mr. Chairman, Representative Sweden, right, and I I think my only comment is, again, the role we play in trying to be neutral, and yet our message that we've attended city council meetings more of just for that purpose. The charities need to be aware. The local units of government need to be aware. The youth, hockey, the veterans, because the pattern that we're seeing is there is an impact. To the extent it comes back, we haven't seen that yet. And so the message is, in light of that, if that happens, they need to take the proper steps to prepare for that. What they were expecting and what they were used to will not continue.
But Mr. Chairman, Tom, you
can just the representative
points of the effects in those certain communities. You just testified to that in those communities that have gone an outright total ban. Smoking out. You testified that you have seen a consequence, significant.
Mr. Chair, representative, yes, and I think some of the folks will say, but they'll come back. And I don't think we've seen it come back yet. It's still continuing to drop. And that's where the charities, the veterans, the people...
Not only going to close my VFW, it's going to close my Girls Softball Association. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you. Representative Hilke, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Representative Hartman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really want to ask about cow bingo, but instead I'm going to ask about your concern about Texas Hold'em and what potential impact that could have on you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, thank you, because again, this is
Mr. Mayor.
A couple of things that we don't regulate. They're not involved in Texas Hold'em, but the charitable gaming is out in those sites that have it. And we did work with public safety and legislators to find a way, because I think the bar industry wanted to find a way to get folks to the bars and keep it legal without having card rooms open up at each location. And so the key provision that was passed when the allowance for Texas Hold'em was made, the key provision was that no consideration. In other words, it can't cost you or players for the privilege to come in there and play Texas Hold'em. That is the key. And I think for the most part it's kept things to a minimum. When it first passed, there's a tremendous increase in that kind of activity. I think a lot of bar owners didn't want to be left out if it got to be real successful. We have now seen a settling where the ones that know how to run the game, but we're also hearing that there's consideration in light of the bans or whatever. Is there a way to allow Texas Hold'em to come under charitable gambling? We've met briefly with some of the representatives from the industry to see what they're talking about. We haven't seen anything formal, but it just, we're not sitting back. We're looking at what-if scenarios. If it were to come to that, how would we respond to you based on whatever they're proposing? How would we regulate it? But I don't want to go there yet, but I know they're talking about it, and to the extent that it's worthy of consideration, I don't know.
Thank you.
So just to follow up, I was the co-author of that bill with Representative Hackbarth, and he's always careful to remind me that Texas Hold'em isn't gambling, it's a game of skill.
Any final questions? See, men, we want to thank the testifiers today, Mr. Harris, Mr. Kruger, and Mr. Baird. Fine job. You presented lots of information to us. Also want to thank the members, and have one more announcement before we leave today. Members, on Thursday, Representative Connell will be back, so you can breathe easy at that time. And then also, we're meeting a new place on Thursday in the basement. Correct, Brian? In the basement of the SOB building, not here. So I just want to make that announcement as well. No, just for Thursday. Meeting adjourned.